So whenever you eventually sell the property, you will have to claim depreciation recapture on everything that you claim depreciation capped out at 25%. Now, it is a deferral method, but you can eliminate that tax or avoid that tax if you're strategic enough.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to another Finance Friday episode. I'm your host, Sean Winslow, and this is the Multifamily Money Podcast. What is going on, everyone? You know the drill. Every Friday, we're coming at you with tips, tricks, and strategies on not only how to get your money working harder for you, but also smarter. So, you know, we can get back that time freedom. We can achieve that financial freedom so we can all go out there and just get after our dreams. Whatever type of life you want to live, I'm here to give you those tips, these strategies to do that. And then it gives us back the time so we can really go after our passions, make the world a better place. That is really needed right now. And I feel if you focus on personal excellence, that's the best way to make the world a better place. It's like that old saying on the plane, you put your oxygen mask on before you help someone else, because you got to take care of yourself first before you can help others. And I think financial freedom, getting back your time, that time freedom, that's one of the best ways to do it. Because then you can really, once you have everything at home taken care of, you know, once your whole life is self-sufficient, it can take care of itself, then you can go help others. And so that's what I come on here to do, is give what I've learned back to you all, and also bring on awesome guests that have a lot of knowledge that they can share with all of us to help us achieve those goals. And that's what I have here today. We have a great guest, Grant Doherty, based out of Houston, Texas. He is a tax advisor. And we're talking all things tax, the benefits of investing in real estate. We get into just some topics outside of real estate as well. Why it's such a great investment on from a tax basis, not even getting into the other benefits of investing in real estate. So this is a really good show, stuff you're going to take notes on. He talks about stuff that like a lot of people just, there is one topic I didn't even know that really existed. And it's things I bet a lot of people could take advantage of. So pay attention to this one and enjoy. All right. Let's welcome Grant to the show. Hey, Grant, welcome to the show, my friend.
Hey, what's going on, Sean? Thanks for having me, man.
Man, thank you for taking time out of your day. I'm excited about this one, which might be weird to some people that I'm excited to talk tax, but I just like things with strategy that you can take advantage of things. And it just gets me going when I learn new things. But
yeah, no, well, especially whenever you start talking about like, you know, rental real estate and the tax implications of that, because a lot of people don't realize it. The tax code, it mostly tells you how to avoid taxes. So like there's a few stats out there. There's like 75,000 pages in the tax code. And like over 90% of it tells you how to avoid tax instead of how to pay tax. And coincidentally enough, real estate is one of the largest sections in there. You know, there's so many different tax incentives of just owning real estate, just rental real estate, to actually personally owning like a personal home. So, you know, there's tons and tons of benefits out there.
Yeah. And that word you said, incentives, that's what I always bring to people's attention when they're like, well, why are there tax benefits to real estate? Well, the government wants to incentivize people, investors to invest, one, maybe building new housing or buying and maintaining existing, because shelter is a need for all people. And they want to incentivize us, one, build it and take care of it.
And they've also done studies on it. Whenever the government tries to run the housing and different things like that, it's not run as efficient as if you open up to the open market. So yeah, there's always a reason why they provide the incentives, is because they don't want to do it. Like, they're not as efficient as if they were to allow investors to come in and actually operate it. Now, of course, there's always legal things you have to look into, because a lot of landlord problems all across the country. So it's a nice healthy balance, I'd say. A healthier balance in some places versus others, but that all depends on your location.
Yeah, for sure. All right, before we get into too much, let's just hear, everyone loves a good origin story. Who is Grant and what do you do?
Yeah, no, my name is Grant Doherty, born and raised in Houston, Texas. I went to school to study finance and accounting. I was also a baseball player in school, cool. So I was able to get out without any student debt. So that was a big plus for like my wealth building journey and things like that. I've been in the industry now almost 6 years, 3 years fully self-employed, just doing taxes. I feel like I learn something new almost every single day. Like, there's just so much information out there. I'm a licensed enrolled agent, so I did have to pass a 3-part comprehensive test administered by the IRS to get my license. And even as a licensed tax advisor, I still feel like I learn something new all the time. So it's really a joy.
And it's always changing too. So even if you learned everything today, which is probably impossible, but even if you did, it's going to change tomorrow, right?
Yeah, man. And speaking of, there's supposed to be some new changes coming to the tax laws if they're able to pass the Inflation Reduction Act. And so it's always good to stay up on what is the government incentivizing business owners and taxpayers to do.
Yeah, that's why people should hire a good tax advisor like yourself, because like, I don't have time to know everything I can take advantage of. Like, I try to do my best, what you're a professional at. So
yeah. And whenever stuff like this, new things come out, new policies or whatever, at least myself as a tax professional, I take it upon, I want to go and learn as much as I possibly can about that. So I'll do a ton of studying, and not everyone has the time to just study this type of material, right? You know, maybe a doctor, you may be an engineer, whatever the case may be. So yeah, you don't have time to look at the tax laws. So I always recommend, if you have a business or if you own any type of real estate, you should almost certainly be working with a professional. If you're just a W-2 employee with maybe like some stocks and bonds, or, you know, a few investments like that, it may not be as critical. Actually, in fact, one of the things, some of the funding for the new IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, some of it's actually going to go towards, I read about it, it's a new taxpayer portal, so that like for certain tax returns, taxpayers would just be able to file their taxes for free instead of go through TurboTax or anything like that. So I would probably recommend it, again, if you have a very simplistic return. The moment you start getting a little bit more complex, you may want to still get with someone.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. All right, let's just get into it though. Like, obviously this is real estate, multifamily apartment specific podcast, but I do every Friday have a Finance Friday episode where we talk about personal finance too, which this is awesome for as well. Let's talk about some strategies, the tax benefits of investing in real estate. I don't know where you want to start. I know that's a vague question with a huge list, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so probably the very first thing that I think everyone should know about is like their personal home residence, right? So if you buy a personal home residence, you own the home. And the rule is, if you live in that home for 2 years in a 5-year span, you can sell that home, and you can exclude, if you're single, it's $250,000 of the first capital gains, completely tax-free. And if you're married finally jointly, it's $500,000 of capital gains, completely tax-free. So especially with 2021, you saw a massive appreciation in a lot of home values. You saw a lot of people cashing out and locking in that tax-free capital gain. So that's very strategic that you can do, that most people can do if they go and they purchase a home. Now, on the flip side, you have rental properties. And I don't know if y'all can hear my son in the background. He's making noise. I'm talking about rentals, so he's getting excited. So,
hey, I don't blame him.
Yeah, no, I don't blame him either, man. So, but the most strategic things about owning rental properties is rental income by nature is passive. And one of the big benefits of having passive income is that income is not subject to, it's called the working man or working woman's tax, which is Social Security and Medicare tax, 15.3%. of your total earnings has to go to Social Security and Medicare. Well, rental income by nature is passive and is not subject to those taxes. So I always like to look at it as, if you have a business owner and after all expenses have been accounted for, are sitting at $100,000 profit, and you take a real estate investor after all expenses have been accounted for, and they end up with $100,000 of profit, the real estate investor will pay less in tax than the business owner because they don't have to pay that additional 15.3% of Social Security and Medicare taxes. So right off the bat, that's a great way. Putting money into a retirement account, 401k, IRA, that is awesome. I would never tell someone to not do that. But there's also, if you want to shift the mindset a little bit, you could build a passive rental portfolio, and that could essentially be your retirement savings, if you will, because the moment you stop working, your income may drop a little bit, but you'll still have that rental income and it's not subject to that leg of tax. So it can be very, very strategic. Now, whenever you own rental properties, I think one of the biggest things that I see that can be missed and quite frankly misunderstood is depreciation. So whenever you purchase a rental property, you are allowed to claim depreciation on that property. And that's line 18 on your Schedule E. So if you've been filing your own tax returns, I highly recommend go back and look and make sure that you have line 18 filled out. I would say nearly 25 to 30% of all the returns that I review that have Schedule E's, they leave off line 18 depreciation.
Really?
It's a very common thing. It mostly happens with self-prepared returns. But whenever you get with a professional, generally that's when it gets a little bit more cleaned up. But it's a very common thing. And calculating depreciation, if you have a residential property, your property is depreciated at 27 and a half years. And if you have a commercial property, it's depreciated at 39 years. And another, I guess, misunderstanding is that, okay, so I bought my property, but it's older than 27 and a half years, or it's older than 39 years. Can I still claim depreciation? And so the answer really depends on when you purchased the property. So if you purchased a property that was built in 1800, but you purchased it in 2000, now you are still able to claim depreciation because it's based on when you purchased the property, not whenever the property was built. So that's a big misunderstanding that I run across a lot with different real estate investors, especially ones that don't work with tax professionals. And so whenever you're working with depreciation, there's actually ways to speed up the amount of depreciation that you can claim on a rental property. And it's with a strategy called cost segregation. It's a cost segregation analysis. Now, before we dive too much into it, it is important to understand that cost seg, if you get with like a professional to come out, implement a cost seg for you, it can be kind of expensive. They can easily charge you $5,000, $6,000 to do a cost segregation analysis on your property. So you'd want to make sure that the benefit, the tax savings that you would receive from this increased amount of depreciation offsets the cost that you would be incurring. But, you know, if you own several, you know, multiple rental properties, or you just recently acquired new properties and you have a large rental portfolio that you are looking to offset, cost seg is a great strategy to implement. And essentially what it is let's just take a residential building. This residential building is depreciated at 27 and a half years. So if it was, let's say, $100,000, you would take $100,000 divided by 27 and a half, and that's your depreciation deduction. One thing to keep in mind is you can't depreciate land. So if you buy, let's say you buy a property at $150,000, that property, the $150,000, includes the structure and the land. So you would have to have those separated out, and then you can only depreciate the structure. So let's say you buy for $150,000 and the structure is valued at $100,000. So that $50,000, you can't depreciate that, but you can depreciate from the $100,000. Well, that structure itself, even though it's depreciated at 27 and a half years, it is made up different components in the building that can be depreciated at much quicker rates. And so you'd be looking at things like your oven, your microwave, your sink. Maybe if you have like different types of carpeting, if you have a driveway or even like a walkway, walking up to the property, porches, fences, all that can be depreciated at much quicker rates. So now you have this $100,000 building that's made up of components that total up to $20,000. So essentially you can get an immediate deduction with bonus depreciation of that $20,000 that can be reclassified as a different depreciable asset. And now you've just essentially sped up the depreciation that you can claim on that property. So it's a pretty strategic strategy to implement for real estate investors.
Yeah, it's probably one of my favorite benefits. And to your point of you want to weigh whether it's cost effective to do it, in my experience, I've always gotten like, they'll give you like a preliminary report that won't be like 100% the number, but it'll be pretty close. And they usually do that for free. So then you can really weigh like, okay, it's going to cost me this. Is it worth it? Like if you're spending $5,000 and going to get less in depreciation, is it worth it? Right.
Oh yeah. No. I'd say for most, if you have a large portfolio that has generated a lot of rental income, more than likely would be worth it. Now, the other time where it may be beneficial to do a cost seg is if initially we said that rental income is passive by nature, but right, there are certain actions that you can take to turn the income from passive to active. And if you are able to take those actions to turn it into active income, then the depreciation that you would claim, if you register a loss, that could offset any business or W-2 income that you may have already had. So that's another time where it makes a lot of sense. Like you have a high W-2 earning taxpayer, and they're married to their spouse. If their spouse qualifies as a real estate professional and materially participates in their rentals, if they run a cost seg and they run a loss on those properties, that loss could offset the W-2 income. So that can be very strategic, especially when you're talking about like high earning individuals that are maybe in like the top tax bracket. So now you're talking about recovering a lot of the taxes that were withheld throughout the year. So it would be very, very powerful.
That's one of the huge things a lot of people don't know. Listeners that aren't familiar, it's like Grant was saying, traditionally that it's a passive loss depreciation. So it would only go against passive income unless you classify as that real estate professional. which is huge. Because yeah, if you or your spouse are a high income earner, that could make a huge difference. So
it also really works. So that real estate professional status. So let me backtrack. Like you said, the passive losses can only offset passive income, but there's actually a special provision. It's called the mom and pop real estate loophole. It's like probably one of the most middle class friendly tax incentives out there for owning real estate. And essentially what it is if you make under $100,000 of modified adjusted gross income, then you can use up to $25,000 of passive losses to offset your active income if you meet active participation requirements in the property. And then there's actually a phase out on that $25,000 deduction. It completely phases out whenever you reach $150,000 of modified adjusted gross income. So basically for every $2 that you make over $100,000, you lose $1 of that deduction, of that $25,000 deduction. So that's one way that you could actually keep it as passive income and use it to offset active earnings is if you meet that mom and pop real estate loophole. $100,000 of modified adjusted gross income to $150,000.
That's cool. I didn't know that. I'm sure a lot of people didn't know that.
Yeah.
And to go back to that example you had of spouse who made a high income, active W-2 income, and then the other spouse that was a real estate professional, you mentioned, and I haven't really heard this before, probably because a lot of people just gloss over it, but I think you said they need to have some type of material involvement in the real estate. So if I was a real estate professional, say my spouse was a high income earner, could I take the depreciation offset my spouse's active income, or would she have to be active in my real estate dealings?
That's a good question. So you would have to be active in your real estate dealings. So it's actually two tests. And this is exclusive of the mom and pop real estate loophole.
Right.
This is now for high earners. So yeah, you have to meet two tests. The first test is real estate professional status. But then on top of that, you have to meet material participation in the rental properties that you are going to be claiming for the depreciation. So now you can group material participation amongst properties. It's tougher to meet material participation tests whenever you participate in one property. Generally, whenever you get to like 3, 4, 5 properties, it becomes a little bit easier to meet material participation. But yeah, two tests. The first one, real estate professional, is 750 hours spent as in a qualified real property trade or business. And over half of your personal services rendered on the year must be in a real property trade or business. So if you have like a W-2 job and you work 40 hours a week, you'd have to turn around and work 41 hours in that same week on your real property trade or business. So you probably can't do it if you have a W-2. You probably can't meet real estate professional status if you have a W-2. Now, the second test is material participation. There's 7 tests to meet material participation. The 2 most common are going to be the gold standard, which is 500 hours. If you materially participate for 500 hours, then you meet the test. The other one is you have to materially participate for at least 100 hours. And that 100 hours must be more than anyone else that worked on the property. So those are the 2 most common tests. And you have to meet both material participation and real estate professional status. One thing should be noted, though, is that hours that you spend on material participation, a lot of times cross over and count for hours as real estate professional status. But not all hours you spend on real estate professional status qualify for material participation. So that's one thing to keep in mind.
Right. So let me clarify just to make sure I'm understanding. So only one spouse has to qualify as a real estate professional.
Mm-hmm.
Both have to have material.
No.
Just one. Okay.
Yeah, just one would need the material participation.
Okay. That's powerful then, because so essentially the high income earner qualified for neither of those, but the other spouse could qualify for both.
Exactly.
And then the depreciation could offset the high income. Wow. That's really powerful.
That's something that you see a lot with high earning taxpayers that use real estate to offset their earned income. It used to be like a real big deal, like back in like the 80s, there wasn't a real estate professional status. You could just be a lawyer, buy some property and use depreciation to offset your income. And it became a real big problem real quick. So that's when they included this real estate professional status. And that's kind of like now what you see is you'll have one high earning income spouse while the other goes and materially participates as a real estate professional.
Yeah. So let's talk about the term depreciation recapture.
Oh, yeah, that's a good.
A lot of people will bring that up when you say you're just deferring it, right? So what would be your counterpoint to that?
Yeah, no. So they are right. Whenever you claim depreciation, it is a method of deferment. So whenever you eventually sell the property, you will have to claim depreciation recapture on everything that you claimed depreciation on, capped out at 25%. Now, it is a deferral method, but you can eliminate that tax or avoid that tax if you're strategic enough. And the two most common ways that I see people avoiding depreciation recapture, well, there's three of them. The first one, you can 1031 exchange, because that, again, it defers, kicks the can down the road a little bit, but you can avoid the depreciation recapture when you do it. It does follow you over to the next property. But what you'll see a lot of generational wealth building families do is they will kick the can down the road with a 1031, and then they'll pass. They'll die with the property still in their name. They'll probably put it in a trust or something. And then their heirs will receive the property with a stepped up basis. So whenever their heirs receive it, then they get that stepped up basis. They've avoided all that depreciation recapture tax and all the previous capital gains that they would have owed. And essentially, they can either start the process over of depreciating from the new stepped up basis, or they could sell it and not really have much of a capital gain to deal with at all. So that's one option. And there's different implications on the state. Every state is different whenever it comes to like legal matters like that. So you'd want to get with a tax attorney that's very familiar with your state. But that's one option you could do. The second option, it's actually not as well known, but essentially that depreciation expense that you could claim, that can offset your capital gains from the sale of another property. And it can also offset depreciation recapture. So you essentially, you could just go ahead and sell the property and you would lock in, you know, depreciation recapture tax and any capital gains tax. But if you purchased another rental property and ran a cost seg, that property registered a loss, then that loss could offset the capital gains and depreciation recapture that you incurred from the sale of the previous property. So that's two ways to avoid that tax, but it is definitely something to keep in mind of.
Yeah, yeah. And that's important too, because there's that 25% cap. And you can also obviously 1031 and exchange into a like-kind property. Which is, to your point, that's a great way of wealth building, because not only are you kicking the can down the road, but usually when you sell, you're selling for a profit, so then you can buy something bigger and better.
Yeah, you're supposed to get something bigger and better.
Right. Yeah. And then the whole thing of selling a property, buying another, and that new bonus depreciation can offset it.
Oh, yeah. That's my personal favorite, because, you know, that's like whenever you 1031 and you do the step up in basis, there's a lot of risk involved with that. You know, there's a lot of legalities, a lot of administrative faults that could easily arise. So it's good. It's also more time consuming versus you could immediately eliminate that tax by now. Of course, if you run a cost seg on the new property, now you just kind of brought more depreciation recapture that's kind of like being deferred a little bit, but you did just offset all the previous that you just had, and it can be done again and again. So
right.
There's different strokes for different folks.
And the depreciation right now, or the bonus depreciation right now, is 100%. It's phasing out, correct? Not completely, but yeah.
It goes to 80% next year and then drops to 60, 40, and then 20, and then it'll be completely phased out unless they bring it back.
Which I don't have a crystal ball, but I would assume they would, maybe not in the same capacity as it's been, but
yeah, it depends. Because here's the thing, like there are arguments against it for strategic purposes, right? One of the big ones is like, okay, do I get this massive amount of depreciation right now? I'm already kind of in a low tax bracket, so it's not really going to save me a whole lot of taxes by just getting a massive deduction right now. What I could do is I could take that deduction and just spread it out amongst the next few years where I may see an increase in income. And now I have a deduction waiting for me to take against that income. So it all depends. It really all, political climate is a big one too. So like they may bring it back, they may not. There's just really just no telling. It's just best to go ahead and plan for what they have set in stone right now. And then if they change it, just move forward from there.
Yeah. If you don't have a lot of income, you can roll over the depreciation to
yes.
The following year. There's a limit though, right?
Like no. Any unused losses from your rental properties carry over to the next year until you eventually use them.
Or you sell, right? And then it's recaptured.
Or until you sell, yes.
Yeah, let's talk about, we kind of briefly talked about this before we hit record. And I think this is really important. A lot of people don't think about it beforehand. They're just like, I want to buy real estate now, so let's go buy a deal. But there is benefits to setting up a certain type of entity. And there's a lot of different structures out there. So if you wouldn't mind just going over what's kind of the most advantageous for people. And I'm sure it makes a difference of what your end goal is or what you're actually doing. But
yeah, most businesses, most real estate investors would probably be good to just keep things as simplistic as possible. A simple single member LLC or a multi-member LLC is probably really all that you'll need. Sole proprietorship or partnership, no need to set up the S corporate, definitely not an S corporation, and not really much of a reason to set up as a C corporation either. One of the big reasons is there's just a lot of taxable events, a lot of hidden taxable events that you could potentially walk across if you put rental properties into a corporation. For example, if you put a rental property into a corporation, if you don't own 80% or more of that corporation, it's a taxable event. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Whenever you move the property out, it's capital gains to all the shareholders. For S-corps, one of the reasons why business owners will make an election to be taxed as an S-corp is so that they can avoid the amount of Social Security and Medicare taxes that they pay on their earnings. Well, rental properties aren't subject to that tax anyway. So putting the property into an S-corp, you have to essentially pay yourself a salary, which is going to be subject to those taxes. So there's just a lot of problems by putting rentals into an S-corp. Highly recommend not doing that. Every now and then, maybe if you have like a hotel, you actually run a business with that rental property, it may make sense. But most of the times, it's just better to keep it as like a single member LLC or like a multi-member LLC.
Okay. And let's say this is kind of for my benefit, but if you're syndicating, you're syndicating multiple deals, and you obviously have one entity that owns an ownership in all the different syndications.
Mm-hmm.
How would you set that up? Would you still shy away from an S corp?
Yeah, I probably would, unless there's like earned income nature about it. Like you have a hotel, or maybe you're doing like fix and flips. If you're doing fix and flips, the house is actually not considered an asset. It's actually considered inventory at that point. So it'd be a little different. But if it's going to be just strictly passive income, I would just keep it sole proprietorship, partnership. Don't make it any more complex than it needs to be.
But if you're getting fees from like an acquisition fee, asset management fee, that's probably considered active, correct?
No, I'd have to see the structure of how it's all set up, but more than likely, probably not.
Okay.
Now, it depends. Like, there may be members in the syndication that meet the active standards. Maybe they qualify as a real estate professional and meet material participation, so it may be different for them. But for you, if you were just like to receive a check, it would still be very passive.
Oh, no, I'm active. If I'm managing the syndication, I oversee the property management company. Like, for one of my properties next week, I'll be flying down to oversee renovations. Would that then make the structure different?
I would probably need to, again, take a look at It sounds like I would probably still keep it as like partnership. I would have to see a lot. Now, if you have two different components to the business, maybe you could separate the business into two separate entities, keep the rental income and like try to keep it as passive as possible. And maybe if you have like management fees or any type of assets under management fee, maybe you could separate that into a separate entity. Maybe keep the income separate.
It's like XYZ Holdings and XYZ Management.
Yeah, or something like that.
Okay.
And maybe have the management as an S corp and then keep the rental properties as a sole proprietorship or partnership.
Okay, cool. All right, thanks, man. Well, I was thinking, like, what are typical things that the average real estate investor or just like the average person in general just doesn't take advantage of? Like when you're doing returns, what do you usually see?
Yeah, the biggest one is going to be line 18, depreciation. So I couldn't tell you that. I see that missed a lot. Something else that I also see misunderstood a lot is repairs versus improvements, right? So if you make an improvement to a property, that gets added to your basis and you can't just immediately deduct that amount. Repairs, you can deduct those. Now, there is a few exclusions like the de minimis safe harbor exclusion, where if the repair is under $2,500, then you can go ahead and deduct that in the first year. But if you have to get a new HVAC unit or something like that, that just gets added to the basis of the property and depreciated over 27 and a half or 39 years.
Okay. All right. That's awesome. Before I ask you some final questions, before I forget, where can people find you?
Oh, yeah. No, they can find me on Instagram at Doherty Tax Solutions. I'm also on Twitter at Doe Tax Solutions. And then I'm also on Facebook as well. And then I have a website. My office cell is 281-217-6767. You know, they're more than welcome to shoot me a text. Most responsive on my office cell, but then after that, it'd probably be like my emails and then my social media.
Love it, man. And guys, I don't follow him on Twitter, but I'll check it out after this, but follow him on Instagram and he's a great follow. So I'd highly recommend.
Appreciate it, man.
Always throwing some good nuggets out there and I'm learning something. So
The average client who I work with, they make under $1 million and they either own rental properties or they are small business owners. So I do work with business owners and rental investors as well.
Love it, man. Yeah, I love when tax advisors have kind of like a niche and they're like specific because they're just like in that every day and they know the stuff. Like if you get a general kind of tax advisor, they don't really know everything that you would know about rental properties and businesses. So
right. Well, there's a lot to it, man, especially when you start talking about like one of the more complex issues can really revolve down to who claims children. So like sometimes you have couples that live together, they're like not married. So then one wants to claim head of household and one wants to claim single, and then the head of household claims the children. This stuff really can get complex. And like you said, there's different niches that go into it, and there's a lot that goes into just like something as simple as your filing status, head of household, married filing jointly. Like there's a lot that can go into it. So, and then don't let there be an issue where you have like a married couple. And I'm in Texas. Gambling isn't legal in Texas, but if you go over to Louisiana, you can go gamble. And I've had a few instances where a spouse goes to Louisiana, wins like $100,000. And then they're like, oh, well, I'm not going to report that. I'm not going to tell my wife about it. And then sure enough, it pops up. So, you know, stuff always gets sticky like that, man.
I'm sure there's some good stories.
Oh, yeah, no, I could tell you guys, I could tell you all some really funny stuff. You know, I've run across all sorts of stuff, like probably another funny one. I work with like a few music producing, like they do like music videos, like they go and they shoot these music videos. And so, I mean, I've run across like thousands of dollars of like alcohol and marijuana and stuff like they're trying to deduct. And it's just like, I get the idea. I get where you're going from. But the only issue is like, so whenever you're talking about marijuana, or like cannabis on a federal level, it's actually illegal. So you can't actually deduct something that's federally illegal on your tax return. But for all these cannabis industries, the way how they get around it is they include it in cost of goods sold. Now you would need a really good accountant that's very familiar with this situation. I don't really deal too much in the cannabis industry, but essentially that's how you would have to go about deducting it or including something like that. But for a music video, it was a funny conversation. I had to pretty much tell him like, hey man, I really don't think this is me we're talking to. So yeah, it's cool. You can tell me jokes all you want. But imagine it's not me. Imagine now you have someone very serious. It's an IRS auditor and they're asking you the same questions. Are you going to joke around with them and tell them like, oh yeah, it was supplies for my, that's not how it works.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, man. Yeah. You run across some funny stuff from time to time. So,
all right. I got final two questions for you. And as everyone knows, I don't really prepare anyone for this. So I want to get what's off the dome right in the moment. So the first one, just answer it by saying like literally everything I just told you, Sean, in this show. But why do you believe that a lot of people choose real estate, specifically rental real estate, to build wealth?
Yeah. So rental real estate, why do I think people do it? Number one, you don't need a college degree to be good at real estate, right? Yeah. I feel like there's a lot of people that they get told like, hey, go to college, get a good job, do this and that. And they realize like you could own rental properties you don't really need. I mean, there's some skills that you learn in college that can definitely be applicable to it, but you don't need a college degree to just be a real estate investor. So not only that, but it provides a great opportunity to create freedom, especially once when you have property management companies that really take care of your clients, of your tenants for you. It really becomes a very passive source of income. And it's much more tax advantage than going out and actually earning the income.
Awesome, man. Great answer. All right. Last question. The good old, if you had a time machine question. And we're going to preface this a little different since this is all, I also do that, the Finance Friday episode on every Friday. So it's personal finance. That's my background. Mm-hmm. So if you had a time machine, go back in time, talk to younger Grant, tell him one piece of financial advice. What would that be?
I would say take that $5,000 that you get from my granddad passed like several years ago. I got $5,000 from like a little insurance policy that he had. I would have taken that and put it into one of these stocks that just boomed. That probably would have been one of my things just because I already know, you know, what it would have been.
Yeah.
But we're talking about fundamentally sound advice. I would say take that money and put it into a Roth IRA. I think rental real estate is a great option, but whenever you know, Roth IRAs are great for building generational wealth because not only do they provide you with tax-free source of income, but in the event that you ever don't need that income, you can pass it on to your kids and they can receive the same tax-free benefits that you would have received. So that can be a very, very powerful tool. And I ended up blowing that $5,000. I can't remember what I spent it on, probably like a fancy restaurant or something like that. I'm a sucker for a dessert. If you have like a good, one of my favorite desserts out here is a creme brulee cheesecake. It's like literally $15 a slice. It's gone in like three bites. So complete waste of money, but it's like so good though. So that's probably what I spent it on.
All right. So you guys want to ever send Grant anything nice, send him some dessert.
There you go.
All right, man. Well, I really appreciate your time. This has been awesome. I've learned some things. So that's, I love when that happens.
Awesome. I'm glad you had me on here, man.
All right. Hey, listeners, as always, thanks for tuning in. And as always, easy doesn't pay well, and instant gratification is self-destructive. So get out there and not only work hard for your money, have your money work hard for you so you can get back that time, get that time freedom, the financial freedom. We can go out there and all make the world a better place. All right. Catch you on the next one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is an investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and, of course, share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.